Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Leonard Leo, and I serve as Executive Vice President of the Federalist Society. It's a pleasure to see all of you here at the Federalist Society's conference reviewing the activities and work of the executive branch. And this is the closing session of a day-long conference we've had that I think has been extraordinarily productive. And it's my privilege to be up here at the podium this afternoon to introduce our closing speaker, Senator Ted Cruz of the United States Senate, who represents the state of Texas. Now, for many of you in this room, Senator Cruz doesn't really require very much of an introduction. And as Justice Scalia once said, the length of an introduction is inversely proportional to one's importance, so I will keep this as short as I can, Senator. Senator Cruz is among the most vocal and energetic advocates for limited constitutional government in our Congress, indeed in national public life right now. And it's very fitting that Senator Cruz is here with us today, because I would submit that there's no one in Congress who has been more systematic in chronicling and critiquing federal branch overreach. As some of you may know, the senator has issued recently four reports that details instances of such federal overreach across the federal government, cabinet departments, as well as the administrative state. You should have at your places today the fourth of those reports, the legal limit, report number four, the Obama administration's abuse of power. One of those reports, one of the early reports, even focuses on the activities of the Justice Department and its litigating positions over the course of the past several years and how those have fared or not before the U.S. Supreme Court. Many of those cases, of course, involve issues of federal overreach. I think it's very important that Senator Cruz is publishing these reports and is trying very hard to focus his own colleagues' attention, as well as the broader public, on issues of executive branch overreach. As many of you know, there hasn't been as much congressional oversight in this area as there may have been in years or decades past. And so I think it is a very important public service that the senator is providing by really detailing the work of the executive branch in the way that he's been doing over the past couple of years. So without further delay, it is my great privilege to introduce to you U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. And thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Leonard. It is great to be back at the Federalist Society. It is great to be back with so many old friends. I would note that walking up here, I observe that Leonard's tie has on it bees. And I ask, is there any particular theme or reason? And Leonard, with a twinkle in his eye, said, well, yes, you know, bees were the symbol of Napoleon, which I thought was fitting given the topic today. Which I have to admit I enjoyed a good chuckle at, and I suspected everyone else here would as well. You know, it was interesting as I was sitting here thinking before getting up, I reflected on the fact that I first became a member of the Federalist Society when I was 21 years old as a 1L in law school. And since I turned 43 just a few months ago, this is now the first year in my life where the majority of my life I have been a member of the Federalist Society. So I think back to those congressional hearings not too long ago where we had the McCarthyite inquiries, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Federalist Society? And I'm glad to say that at least in my case and in the case of a great many of the men and women here, there would be no disputing the evidence on that front. You know, there are a lot of scholars in this room. I look at my old legislation professor, Bill Eskridge, who would study language. You know, if you go to the original Greek behind the word politics, there are actually two roots of the word. Poly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning blood-sucking parasites. I'm not sure about my Greek on that one. But it is a fairly accurate description of the town of Washington, D.C. You know, the last time I was here a year ago for this conference was when I unveiled the first report that we issued. One of the things I'm very proud to serve is as the ranking member on the Constitution Subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. And in that capacity, we've unveiled, as Leonard mentioned, a series of reports on rule of law and abuse of power. The first one governed 9 cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court since January 2012, where the administration had argued for an overbroad view of federal power, and the U.S. Supreme Court had rejected the administration's view unanimously, 9-0. And it simply cataloged, these are not difficult, close questions that are 5-4, that reasonable jurists could differ. These were extreme assertions of federal power. And I'll confess, actually, the origin, the idea for that first report came from the Federalist Society Lawyers' Dinner the year before, where Justice Alito had given a speech to this group actually talking about some of the positions that were being advocated before the court. And what struck me then that Justice Alito pointed out is that in one of the political speech cases, the administration has stood before the U.S. Supreme Court and defended the proposition that the federal government could ban books. And if you look at the questioning, the justices, all of the justices were like, wait, let me make sure I'm getting this. It is really the position of the Department of Justice that consistent with the First Amendment, the federal government could ban books with which it disagrees? Yes, was the answer for the DOJ lawyer. Unsurprisingly, the Supreme Court unanimously disagreed with that proposition. So that report discussed, for example, one case where law enforcement had argued that you could place a GPS sensor on the car of any citizen with no probable cause, no articulable suspicion, no basis whatsoever. And indeed, the argument from the U.S. Department of Justice is the Fourth Amendment has nothing to say about whether the federal government can monitor the movements of law-abiding citizens. Now, unsurprisingly, the Supreme Court 9-0 rejected that proposition. Another case was the Hosanna-Tabor case, dealing with whether churches and religious institutions have a First Amendment right to select their ministers and their teachers. And there's an exchange, which we actually quoted in that first report, where the Department of Justice lawyer argued that the First Amendment had absolutely nothing to say about whether a church had the freedom to select its own ministers and teachers. And there's an exchange with Justice Elena Kagan, that famed right-wing advocate, where she leans forward to this administration's lawyer from the Solicitor General's office and said, I find your position amazing. It's an incredible exchange where from the bench, this president's former Solicitor General says that to a lawyer in her old office, that look, she didn't elaborate on this particular point, but you might be able to argue somehow you can have some constraint consistent with the First Amendment. But to really say the First Amendment has nothing to do with that issue, that is an extraordinary position. Now, the second report we put out dealt with how the administration has been unilaterally rewriting Obamacare. And it has been breathtaking, the degree to which that's happened. The third report dealt with a total of 10 cases involving the state of Texas, where the state of Texas has been forced over and over again to go to court to vindicate its rights and has prevailed over and over again against the administration, vindicating its rights against abuse of power. And then the latest report, just like last year, we are releasing the latest report today, so y'all are getting the very first copies. And this fourth report tries to do something simple. It tries to, rather than focus on any particular tree, focus on the forest. Because I actually think the breadth of the lawlessness in the aggregate is all the more disturbing, that it's not one example or two example or three examples. The Declaration of Independence, I believe, had 28 particulars that King George had committed against the rights of Englishmen. Well, this particular report lists 76 examples of lawlessness and abuse of power. And my hope is that in this instance, rather than having an in-depth discussion of one or two or three or four, that the breadth of it will catalog a case that ought to concern anyone who worries about rule of law. And let me note briefly on rule of law. Look, everyone says they support rule of law. There is not currently in the United States Congress an anti-rule of law caucus. Although, give it time. But rule of law doesn't mean you got a lot of laws. Practically every society on earth has laws. And dictatorships are typically characterized by an abundance of laws. The presence of words on a page in a book that are called laws is not what defines rule of law. Rather, rule of law is the notion that all of our leaders, and especially the president, is bound by law, that no one is above the law. That's what distinguishes rule of law in the United States historically from so many countries across the earth. Now, if you look, I'm going to kind of do some greatest hits from this report and just go through some examples. You've got over and over again, we have not seen an administration where if it disagrees with a particular policy, it simply announces it will not enforce it. So you take welfare laws. The administration disagrees with the work requirements that were passed by overwhelming bipartisan majorities that were signed into law by Democrat President Bill Clinton. Administration disagrees with them. So rather than go to Congress and say, let's amend the work requirements, we don't like them, it simply granted waivers and said, don't worry about the work requirements anymore. Likewise, let's take drug policy. Now, drug policy is a great example of an area where you can find a lot of reasonable disagreement. In this room, a gathering of largely conservatives and libertarians, I suspect we could have a robust debate about what should be the appropriate drug policy. Indeed, I would note, I'm a co-sponsor, along with Mike Lee and Rand Paul, with sentencing reform to lessen some of the draconian drug sentences and mandatory minimums we've had. So on the policy area, we could find real bipartisan agreement. Bill Otis is glaring at me for that one, but that's okay. We could find real bipartisan agreement on a lot of issues, and we could have a sensible policy discussion about what should be the right rules and standards and laws. And indeed, I suspect Congress would be perfectly happy to engage in that discussion. The president didn't do that. Eric Holder simply announced the following drug crimes were no longer prosecuted. We don't agree with their mandatory minimums. And this, by the way, some folks in the press have misunderstood this point to say that I was criticizing in particular the laws concerning Colorado and Washington State. I will note, though, earlier today, the brownies outside were provided by the state of Colorado. So if my speech appears to be in technicolor, perhaps it will render it a bit more enjoyable. But the point actually has nothing to do with the limited states that have made the decision, the extraordinary decision to legalize marijuana. It has to do rather with what the Department of Justice has done across the board, saying entire categories of drug crimes won't be prosecuted. Now, if you want to change the criminal laws, there's a process for doing so. You can go to Congress, you can present witnesses, you can suggest an amendment, you can change the laws. And by the way, these are criminal laws. These are laws that say if you can commit certain conduct, the penalty shall be incarceration, often for a minimum of 10 years. It is extraordinary for the administration simply to announce, we don't agree with it, we will not enforce it. Likewise on marriage. You have the state of Utah, for example, litigation is ongoing concerning its marriage laws. U.S. Supreme Court stayed litigation there, where there's a challenge to Utah's marriage that recognizes marriage as the union of one man and one woman. The administration announced it's going to disregard the Supreme Court stay, and it's going to enforce and recognize marriages that Utah law doesn't allow and that the courts don't allow. Yet another example is immigration. Look, there are many issues on immigration. Reasonable minds can differ. We can have discussions about immigration. But you look at, for example, the president announcing when the DREAM Act didn't pass Congress. Right before the last election, he suddenly announced some 800,000 people who are here illegally, he was unilaterally granting them amnesty. Now, some people in this room may agree with that as a policy matter. You could have a debate about what should the immigration laws be. We're having those debates. That's what the democratic process is set up for. It's qualitatively different when the executive says, never mind that Article 2 gives the president a duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Nonetheless, when the executive says, if I disagree with this, I hereby decree we will not follow it. There are more examples. You look at what's happening on national security. We saw just this past week the House of Representatives convene a select committee on Benghazi. I'm very glad of that. For nearly a year now, I've been calling on a joint select committee in both houses of Congress to investigate what happened in Benghazi, why we didn't provide security that was repeatedly requested by our diplomats on the ground, why we didn't have assets nearby to prevent the murder of four Americans, including the first U.S. ambassador killed in the line of duty since 1979. And why, in the 19 months that have followed, no one has been brought to justice. Now, one component of Benghazi we have seen is we have seen an administration stonewalling Congress. What prompted the Select Committee was the release in litigation just this past couple of weeks of internal emails from senior officials in the White House directing public spokespeople to go out and carry a political message that the terrorist attack that was carried out by radical Islamic terrorists was not in fact a terrorist attack, but rather had to do with some silly internet video for which there was no evidence from the ground that there was any involvement whatsoever. And this particular email is framed in very political terms, that the critical objective here is to make clear whatever happened, it's not the fault of any policies of this administration. And this is from a senior official at the National Security Council of the White House to the communications staff and everyone else going out pushing this message. Now, why is this so notable? A, that you have in writing, notably the White House has maintained for over a year. It had nothing to do with the talking points, the messages, except for the fact that it put in writing exactly what it wanted them to be. And moreover, that it had repeatedly defied congressional subpoenas, which is, I think, what prompted the investigation. We've had testimony that a senior political official for Hillary Clinton reached out to career Foreign Service officers and told them, do not speak to Congress, do not speak to members of the press about what occurred. Now, for the former or current prosecutors in the room, usually when you're asking witnesses to criminal activity not to share about that, in the non-political world, that used to be called obstruction of justice. And yet here, sadly, it's just treated as yet more politics. You look at, in another context, we say what's happening in Russia. Well, you know, one component of what's happening in Russia is the administration has refused to enforce the Magnitsky Act, an act, a bipartisan act, introduced by a Democrat in the Senate to punish human rights violators in Russia. And yet the administration simply refused to enforce it, said, we're not going to enforce this. Now, how exactly do we go to Putin and say, you need to be bound by rule of law, when simultaneously our government is saying, never mind the laws our Congress passed, we're going to disregard them? Reminds me of, there was recently a Jimmy Kimmel exchange where Kimmel did a fake phone conversation between Obama and Putin. This is right after the invasion of Ukraine, and he has President Obama saying, Mr. Putin, you can't force people to do things against the democratic will of the people. and Kimmel playing, Putin says, "Yes, in Russia we have a word for this. It's called Obamacare." And speaking of Obamacare, take Obamacare. Please, take Obamacare. If you were to embody one example of lawlessness, it would be difficult to come up with a more comprehensive example than Obamacare. Over and over and over again, the administration has disregarded the law. It illegally granted a waiver to big business. Not a word in the law says anything about a waiver for big business. The law says the employer mandate kicks in January 1st, 2014. The administration announced, no, it doesn't. And by the way, how did it do so? In a blog post by an assistant treasury secretary, put up right around the 4th of July, by the way, big business hereby gets this waiver. It was framed a little more wonky than that. Likewise, members of Congress. The text of the statute says members of Congress shall be bound by Obamacare, shall be on the Obamacare exchange without employer subsidies, just like millions of Americans. That was the Grassley Amendment, introduced by my friend Senator Chuck Grassley. It was designed to say, look, if we're going to visit this kind of hurt on the American people, members of Congress should suffer under what we're doing to the American people. Well, what ended up happening is they had a closed-door meeting of Harry Reid and the Senate Democrats and President Obama, where suddenly they realized, we don't want to be on Obamacare. And the president unilaterally and illegally directed OPM to grant an exemption for members of Congress. It's directly contrary to the statute. And yet they did so anywhere. You know, another example, in fact, the most striking example, is when we saw last year over 6 million people have their health insurance canceled because of Obamacare, despite the president's repeated promises to the contrary. Any other presidents, the 43 presidents who preceded our current president, if that had happened, they would have come to Congress. They would have said, listen, this federal law is a disaster. It is hurting. Over 6 million people have lost their health insurance. We need to get together and fix this. We need to do something to provide relief for the Americans we've hurt. The president didn't do that. Instead, he held a press conference. He held a press conference where he instructed private insurance companies, go and violate the law. I am telling you, as President of the United States, go and issue policies that the text of the statute says are illegal. And for 1 year, disregard the text of the statute. Because by presidential grace and whim, I'm telling you to do so. I want you to think for a second in the over 200 years of our nation's history. We have never had an instance where the President of the United States instructs private citizens and private companies to go and violate the law at the presidential discretion and whim. That is an ominous development. You look at the economy, where the administration attempted to force Boeing to fire over 1,000 employees in South Carolina because it was a non-union state. And they took the position, by the way, that they should padlock the plant and it would be better to have the plant in China than to allow it to occur in a state in the union that didn't have mandatory union membership and forced union dues. It's an extraordinary position. Likewise, offshore drilling, following the disaster of the Deepwater Horizon spill, the administration unilaterally issued a moratorium on offshore drilling. Now, mind you, it did so by convening a panel of experts. A panel of experts prepared recommendations on what to do to improve safety for deepwater drilling. After the report was written, political operatives in the administration wrote the offshore drilling moratorium on top of it. The members of the panel, when the report was released, said, wait a second, this wasn't in the report we wrote, this wasn't in the report we signed off. The moratorium came from the political appointees, not from the experts. Repeatedly, federal courts struck down the moratorium as contrary to law, having no authorization in law to ban deepwater drilling. And repeatedly, the administration reinstated it, defying the courts. You look likewise to the so-called recess nominations that the president made to the Consumer Finance Protection Board and the National Labor Relations Board. The only small problem was they were made when Congress was not in recess. The president has an authority to make appointments when Congress is in recess, but Congress, for 200 plus years, has determined when it's in recess. And the president asserted that the Senate was in recess when we were not. Now, if the president has this power, it altogether guts the confirmation power of the United States Senate. Because if the president could say we're in recess, you know what? Tonight, I'm pretty confident an awful lot of senators are going to go home and go to sleep. I suppose the president could say at 1 a.m, I declare the Senate is in recess and here's all the people I appoint. And suddenly a vice and consent goes away. If the president has the ability to deem the Congress in recess whenever he or she pleases, a critical check and balance, a critical structural constraint of our Constitution is rendered a nullity. Now, that's not just my view. That's the view of 1, 2, 3 different federal courts of appeals, each of which concluded these appointments were unconstitutional. Now, what happened? The administration disregarded the views of 3 federal courts of appeals, continued just right on going. CFPB keeps issuing new regs, keeps operating as if nothing's happened. NLRB keeps behaving as if nothing's happened. Now, you've got this pending at the U.S. Supreme Court. And I am hopeful, I'm optimistic, the Supreme Court's going to agree with the 3 federal courts of appeals. But think about it for a second. To have an administration just ignoring 3 federal courts of appeals. Dean, if you did that, you'd be held in contempt. The rest of us don't have the ability to disregard courts. And yet somehow this administration believes they do. Then you look in the area of free speech and privacy. Take the IRS, for example. It's about 10 months ago that the Inspector General of the IRS, of the Department of Treasury, concluded that the IRS had wrongfully targeted Tea Party groups, conservative groups, pro-Israel groups, pro-life groups. The day that news broke, the president said he was outraged. He was angry, and the American people had a right to be angry. Eric Holder said he was outraged. President Obama pledged to work hand in hand with Congress to get to the bottom of it. That's what they said the day the news broke. In the 10 months since then, not a single person has been indicted. In the 10 months since then, most of the victims of the wrongful targeting have not even been interviewed. In the 10 months since then, the lawyers and investigators working on the investigation have leaked publicly that they do not intend to indict anyone. In the 10 months since then, the head of the office in charge of this, Lois Lerner, twice went before the House of Representatives and pleaded the fifth, which I would note, as everyone here knows, means she raised her hand and said, if I answer your questions, it may well implicate me in criminal conduct. And most strikingly, the 10 months since then, we have discovered that the lawyer put in charge of this investigation in the Department of Justice is a major Obama donor who has given over $6,000 to President Obama and the Democrats. Earlier this year, Attorney General Holder testified before the Judiciary Committee, and I took the opportunity to very gently question him. And I asked General Holder, going through that litany, if he was willing to carry on the bipartisan tradition of the Department of Justice. We've seen attorneys general in both parties willing to resist political pressure from the White House, follow rule of law, and do the right thing. So accordingly, when credible allegations of wrongdoing against Richard Nixon were raised, his attorney general, Elliot Richardson, a Republican, appointed Archibald Cox to investigate and get to the bottom of the matter. And likewise, when credible allegations of wrongdoing were raised against Bill Clinton, his attorney general, Janet Reno, a Democrat, appointed Robert Fisk as an independent counsel to investigate the matter and get to the bottom of it. And I asked Eric Holder in that hearing, would he be willing to demonstrate the same independence, the same fidelity to law demonstrated by his predecessor, and appoint a special prosecutor with meaningful independence who at a minimum was not a major Obama donor? And his answer, I'm sorry to tell you, was flat out no. I see no reason to question the independence of this investigation. It struck me that was part of the problem. Indeed, Eric Holder testified for the Senate Judiciary, there was an ongoing investigation, free of political pressure, free of taint. They were going to get to the bottom of it. 4 days later, 4 days, President Obama went on national television on Bill O'Reilly during the Super Bowl. And he said, there is not a smidgen of corruption concerning the IRS. Now, I have to admit, my first thought was of my favorite movie, The Princess Bride. You keep on using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means. But it really is quite striking, and indeed today I sent a letter to Attorney General Holder pointing out his testimony and 4 days later the President's statement that there was not a smidgen of corruption. I said these two statements are facially inconsistent. If there is in fact a real, meaningful, ongoing investigation free of pressure, how is it that 4 days later the President states categorically on national television there is not a smidgen of corruption? So my question to the Attorney General was President Obama mistaken? Was he mistaken when he told the American people there is no corruption? Or alternatively, did you testify falsely when you told the Judiciary Committee there was an ongoing investigation free of political taint and free of the outcome being dictated? Because those two statements cannot mutually be consistent at the exact same time. We shall see how the Attorney General responds to that letter. I would note beyond that, you've got the repeated invasions of our privacy regarding cell phones. How many of y'all have your cell phones with you, by the way? Let me ask you, please leave your cell phones on. I want to make sure President Obama hears everything we have to say here. And just a couple of months ago, we saw the FCC try to put government monitors in newsrooms. John, if you or I had gone on Fox News and suggested the Obama administration is going to send government monitors into newsrooms, we would have been laughed at as black helicopter kooks. That's crazy conspiracy stuff. Don't worry. It's never going to happen. Don't worry about it at all. And for the record, by the way, I left the tinfoil hat in the car. And yet here was the government saying, we're going to put government monitors in newsrooms. We've covered maybe a dozen of the 76 in this report. I would encourage each of you to read the report, to disseminate the report, and to highlight the lawlessness that threatens the basic underpinnings of our society. In closing, I want to say two things. Number one, Federalist Society is good at a lot of things. One of the things some of the folks here are good at is litigation. There are some smart lawyers, and I would encourage smart lawyers in this room to think about ways to use the federal courts to challenge this pattern of lawlessness. One of the difficulties with many of these acts of lawlessness is they're very cleverly designed to make it difficult to find plaintiffs with standing. I would note, by the way, one of the more recent waivers, where the administration unilaterally announced for employers with between 50 and 99 employees, they're getting an extra year delay on the mandate. That was a couple of months ago. Y'all may have missed it. There have been so many waivers, you may have missed that particular one. I will confess, the litigator in me, the day I saw that news broke, immediately said, aha, they've created standing. Because if you have an employer with 100, 101, 102, 105 employees, under the statute, that employer is supposed to have the burden, and so is the employer with 95 employees. And the administration has now given his competitor a benefit in the marketplace that is contrary to the text of the law. So I note that to some of the more creative legal minds. There are other cases that are pending that I hope are successful, but that have standing challenges. That struck me as one of the clearest instances where there is a clear, discernible set of plaintiffs with standing to challenge it. And it ain't a complicated lawsuit. You know, it used to be that if you wanted to know what the law was, you pull the U.S. Code off the shelf, you read the texts. How many of y'all remember Schoolhouse Rock? You know, how a bill becomes a law? You know, it seems this administration missed that day. But the final point I want to make is these concerns should be bipartisan. Now listen, I recognize there is a poisonous, even toxic atmosphere in Washington where everything gets viewed through a partisan lens, through the battles of one team versus another, one side versus another. But this shouldn't be partisan. Anyone who cares about rule of law, anyone who cares about liberty and the Constitution, should be dismayed about an administration and an executive that is disregarding the law. This should unify Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Libertarians. Everyone should come together. And by the way, for all of those Democrats, for all of those in the media, although I repeat myself, who are saying quietly to themselves, well, I'm a little troubled by this, but you know what? The president's kind of our guy. We like him. We sort of agree with the policies he's doing. Not everything, but generally. So we're going to let it slide. You know, the scriptures tell us there came a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph and his sons. President Obama is not always going to be president. There will come another president, and in time, there will even come a Republican president. And I ask all of those on the left who are so happy about this, how exactly they would feel about a Republican president exercising this power. Now, I would note, a Republican president presumably would have different policy priorities than a Democratic president. So rather than easing the work requirements of welfare, or forcing states to accept gay marriage, or granting amnesty, you might see a Republican president, for example, saying we're not going to enforce certain environmental laws. We're not going to enforce certain labor laws. We're not going to enforce a whole host of laws that our system has worked so hard to pass. And I might know, let me give an example. Here's a policy position I love. I've spent a lot of time saying we should abolish the IRS. We should move to a simple flat tax where every person can pay his or her taxes on a postcard. Now, that's great policy, and I'm happy to fight for it in Congress. But I don't, for the life of me, think the way to get that done is for the president to decree that shall be the outcome. And I want to ask you, imagine what the left would say if a president would say, Heretofore, I'm instructing the Department of Treasury, we shall not collect any taxes above a marginal rate of 20%. Now, some might say, well, how is that analogous? Look, the employer mandate is a tax penalty. It is written in our tax laws, and in saying we are waiving the employer mandate for a certain set of people, the administration is saying, never mind what is written in the tax laws, we can decline to enforce them. Now, let me say right now, as much as I might love that policy of moving to a flat tax, a president doing so unilaterally without working with Congress would be patently illegal and contrary to rule of law. And for anyone who cares about liberty, and that's the great value of the Federalist Society, these are men and women who have wild disagreement on a host of issues, and yet I think are unified by a belief in rule of law and liberty. I would encourage each of you to spread the urgency of the concern that should be a bipartisan concern, that when you have a president who can pick and choose which laws to follow and which laws to ignore, then you no longer have a president. Thank you.
We have time for maybe two questions.
Senator Cruz, thank you very much. Thank you for your zeal for liberty and the rule of law. I'm Doug Wardlow from Minnesota. I wonder, to what extent you think that the forest you're talking about, this breakdown of the rule of law and threat to liberty, is not only being caused by President Obama, but is also a reflection of a cultural shift toward perhaps a view of law that is secular and entirely positivist, and that perhaps President Obama is a symptom of that. And then with that in mind, do you think there can be a political solution to this? Do you see in, say, Texas, your constituents getting excited and interested in rule of law issues? And to what extent do your colleagues in the Senate, especially Republican colleagues, understand the importance of these issues?
It is a great question. I think this is certainly a symptom of a broader trend. And it is a trend that believes that the ends justify the means, and rule of law is an inconvenience. And listen, I will readily concede that abuse of presidential power is not a sin confined to one party, that presidents in both parties have abused their power. The difference, frankly, is that with this administration, you have the Congress of the United States actively aiding and abetting in this endeavor. And you have the press all but silent. If the same acts had been committed by Richard Nixon, every day the front pages of the headlines would be banner headlines. And yet you don't have that kind of scrutiny. In Congress, a couple of months ago, I remember sitting on the floor of the House of Representatives where the president said, if Congress doesn't act, I will. And just about every Democratic member of Congress stood up and cheered. It was surreal. It was like, yes, take away our constitutional authority, usurp the Congress. And I would note that one of the differences when Republican presidents have abused their power. Look, many of y'all are familiar with the biggest case of my tenure as Solicitor General. Case of Medellin versus Texas, where in Medellin, the World Court issued an order to the United States to reopen the convictions of 51 murderers. And in that case, the president, then a Republican, George W. Bush, signed an order purporting to order the state courts to obey the World Court. Now, we had a rigorous debate in the state of Texas about what to do about that. I went to my then boss, Attorney General Greg Abbott, and we discussed, look, it was an unusual position for the state of Texas to litigate against the President of the United States, who happened to be a Republican, who happened to be a Texan, who happened to be a friend. And yet I was very proud that the state made what I think was the right decision to go in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, as I argued twice, that the President of the United States lacks the constitutional authority to give up U.S. sovereignty. And the Supreme Court ultimately agreed 6-3 and struck down the President's order. What we're not seeing here are Democrats willing to stand up to the President. We're seeing very few in the media willing to stand up to the President. We're seeing relatively few in the Academy standing up to the President. And I assume it is because, as I mentioned before, the sense that, well, we're on his team, so we'll let it slide. And that's really how liberty is undermined in the long term.
Senator, I had a question. There was a lot of commotion in the last session over the law of standing. And you pointed out, congenial to what we were talking about in the last session, the lot of items in your list. I'm looking at the governing by executive fiat. You have 9 items there. It looks to me like most of them, it would be very difficult or even impossible to find plaintiffs to challenge this in court. And the Roberts Court has greatly expanded Article 3, which is a kind of judicial activism. Right. No citation to original meaning, no analysis even of the text of the Constitution. But in cases like the Perry case, that was the California marriage case, and the Clapper case, the recent FISA case. So the invitation from a lot of us in the last session is, would you lend your voice as a senator, as a former solicitor of the state of Texas, to those that have criticized the Supreme Court for excessive activism in a broad interpretation of Article 3, which closes off a lot of lawsuits challenging illegal executive action that are plenty adversarial, plenty controversial, plenty cases, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the question. And it's kind of an invitation as well, Senator.
Well, it is a very good question, and I don't know if at the end of this, as in law school, if I will get a grade or not.
I think you did well when I had you as a student at the Harvard Law School.
Which, for a visiting Yale professor, was very kind of you to give a Harvard student a good grade. That demonstrated an ecumenical spirit that was much appreciated.
It demonstrated a student who was brilliant analyst of statutory text, if you remember correctly.
Well,
it was the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which baffled most of the Harvard students, but not the current senator from Texas.
Well, that's very kind of you. I will say on standing, I will readily confess I have not studied the court's recent standing decisions. And so one of the things I try to do when venturing into legal waters is to have some degree of timidity not to opine a legal opinion without studying the relevant case law and constitutional and statutory texts. I will say in this broader issue of abuse of power and how to fix it, so I'll answer at a higher level of principle than whether Smith versus Jones was rightly decided, because I'm not in a position to give an educated opinion on that. What I would say more broadly is I find myself conflicted at this moment, because I do think the degree of lawlessness is unprecedented, and there would be real value for liberty to the courts putting meaningful constraints on it. At the same time, I do think the Article 3 requirements of a case in controversy are meaningful and important, and I think the judgment at the founding of our republic that the court not render advisory opinions was the right judgment to make, even if it means that some issues do not get conclusively resolved for lack of a plaintiff withstanding. And so I will note, I joined as an amicus in one case challenging this, which is my colleague Senator Ron Johnson has filed litigation challenging the congressional exemption from Obamacare, and I joined an amicus. The hardest hurdle he faces in that litigation is standing. There are arguments there that I was willing to put my name to on an amicus brief, and I tried to think long and hard about it before doing so. But much of it was driven by the underlying merits of the issue was pressing enough that I viewed a little bit more breadth in standing being possible. But I, so I think we should be faithful to the constitutional requirements of a case or controversy. And I think the best constraint for this, if you can find plaintiffs with a meaningful, personalized, concrete injury, great, go challenge them. I gave one example that I fervently hope some folks in here will pick up and run with. Beyond that, I think the most important constraint is political. I think the most important constraint should be Congress fighting back. I mean, our checks and balances were designed for the branches of government to wrestle with each other. Part of what has enabled the lawlessness to be so egregious is that the current U.S. Congress, and in particular the Senate, has utterly acquiesced in this. And I'm reminded of Professor Jonathan Turley, whom many people in this room know, who is a well-respected professor, but a professor on the left, who testified before the House that he voted for President Obama in 2008. And it was very interesting what Professor Turley said. He said that President Obama has become the embodiment of the imperial presidency. Barack Obama has become the president that Richard Nixon always wished he could be. Now that, from an academic on the left, I think has particular saliency. I hope it is. There are more on the right and the center and the left who together say, look, regardless of whether we agree or disagree on policy, there is a way to do so consistent with our constitutional structure. And I think if Congress were to press back, if the public were to press back, that would be a meaningful check and balance as well.
So. Let me just add this, that the counter-invitation is for representatives as well as academics and lawyers on the right to interrogate the Article III activism. Because you could actually have an Article III that said no advisory opinions, and that would have a lot more lawsuits against executive misbehavior than the Supreme Court allows now. So that actually might be, to whatever point you become chair of the Judiciary Committee, that actually might be an issue meet for Judiciary Committee hearings.
It may well, and I would note that there is potential cause for that going forward, in that the House is considering, and there are advocates in the Senate for considering legislation to try to expand standing precisely to do this. So it is an issue. I think it would be an excellent issue for a hearing in the Judiciary Committee, and to hear testimony and expert testimony on both sides and again consider the issues.
Thank you, Senator.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. It's well past 3. Senator, I want to thank you for coming here again to the Federalist Society to address us. We're privileged to have you here, and I think the country is privileged to have such an ardent defender of the Constitution in public life. So thank you.
Thank you.
If everyone could just remain seated for a minute so we can have the senator leave swiftly so we can get back to the Senate. And while the senator is on his way out, I just want to, on behalf of the Federalist Society, express our deep appreciation to all of you for being here today, and also especially for a number of the volunteer leaders of the Federalist Society who are here today, some of whom are not, who really made this conference possible by helping to explore various aspects of executive branch activity. So to all of you, we really appreciate your presence and your activity. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.